Good morning, and I want to thank Bayit Adult Education for once again making this possible. And another in our series on medical halacha, how does a doctor choose a rabbi? And I want to thank Albert Kirshen. I can thank him now because he's not here. For all of his help in arranging credit and really encouraging and pushing this series forward. Please do make sure that you sign in, both in order to be able to get credit and in order for me to be able to include you when I send out a follow-up email from this. There are a couple of sign-in sheets around. There's one up here. There are a couple over there with the source sheets. And please make sure to either silence your cell phones or put them on vibrate or whatever you can do to avoid distractions during the class. Somewhat ironically, for a class on how does a doctor choose a rabbi, I'm going to say right now that I'm not poskening anything with this, with what I say. This is not intended to be a halachic statement as much as it's intended to provide guidance. There are many different segments to what we're going to talk about, and really each of them could be a full shiur in its own right. There are probably your four or five mini shiurim that I'm condensing in order to approach the broad topic which was requested. This one came in by popular request, and the question of how does a doctor choose a rabbi. So one other note is that much of this, you'll realize as we go through it, is not really about how a doctor chooses a rabbi per se. It's about how anyone chooses a rabbi. There are a couple of nuances that are medicine specific, but fundamentally these are issues that everyone faces. Michael, can you just slide that door open a little bit, please? Because I know there are people still coming in, and that way they can. Thank you. So I started with what I sourced that I thought was funny from Chabad.org on how do I choose a rabbi. There are two litmus tests you can administer to any rabbi. You'll need a stopwatch. Test number one, ask the rabbi, "Rabbi, do you believe in God?" Start the stopwatch. When you hear the word yes, stop the watch and record the time. Test number two, ask the rabbi, "Okay, let's say they tie you to a post on a pile of kerosene-soaked wood, and these guys in black hoods standing around with torches who look like they've done this before tell you, just say that this Judaism stuff is a bunch of nonsense and we'll let you go. Your answer is..." And start the stopwatch. When you hear the words Shema Yisrael, when you hear the word Shema Yisrael, or some other convincing show of absolute commitment, stop the watch and record the time. Results. 0 to 2 seconds... That's why we are still here today. 3 to 10 seconds. Okay, maybe he was just shocked by the question. 11 seconds to never. If he doesn't really believe in it, why should we? Sources. Test number one is the invention of Dr. Judah Landes, a psychologist who used it to determine his rabbi when he was a senior researcher at Stanford. Test number two was also used many times, but for less honorable purposes and not by psychologists. Send in your results. So I thought that was interesting as an approach to this. I searched on a whole bunch of sites, English and Hebrew, about how do you choose a rabbi. Unfortunately, most of them were how do you choose a rabbi to officiate at a wedding, and not about the broader question. But there were some which dealt with it substantively. And you'll see I have a flow to this. Those who got the email and read it saw the list of questions that I plan to address. I want to begin with the question of whether there's any obligation to choose a rabbi at all. Who says that I have to choose a rabbi? Maybe I can have one rabbi I ask this question to, another one I ask that question to. Who says that there's any need to choose a rabbi? That's number one. Number two, are there certain rabbis who may have sway automatically, and specifically the question of Mara D'Asra? Is there an issue of, well, you have a local rabbi, he's the one who guides the community, he's the one that you're supposed to, that you're supposed to approach. Then, third question is, am I allowed to rely on the answers I see in books? Could my Mara D'Asra be the rabbi who wrote a great medical halacha textbook or medical ethics book? Maybe that's, maybe that's who my rabbi ought to be. And then the question of second opinions. Doctors are certainly familiar with the concept of asking a second opinion. Is it possible to ask a second rabbinic opinion? I asked the rabbi. He gave me one answer, but I want to ask somebody else. And then finally, which traits does one look for in a rabbi when you're talking about finding somebody to answer these questions? So what exactly do we look for? So as you can tell from the list of questions, there is a lot for us to go through, and I'm going to do my best with it. Okay, we begin with, am I obligated to pick a rabbi at all? Or could I ask different poskim, maybe based on convenience? Who I'm around at that time, maybe based on a particular area of specialty, what would you assume? Coming into this, what do you think the answer is? Am I obligated to choose a rabbi at all? Sorry? I see a nodding yes. Based on what? Yeah? Right, Pirkei Avos is usually the go-to source for this. Says it not, no, that's great. Says it not once, but twice. Take a look at source number two, please. Mishnah and Pirkei Avos, both of them are going to be from the first parak, the first chapter. Yoshua ben Prachya, Omer Aseh Lecha Rav, Ukne Lecha Chaver. Yoshua ben Prachya says, make a rabbi for yourself, acquire a friend for yourself. And then the next one, source number three, later in the same chapter in Pirkei Avot, Rabbi Gamliel Omer Aseh Lecha Rav, V'Yistalek Min HaSafek. Make a rabbi for yourself, or I wrote make a teacher for yourself. It's always challenging to translate the word Rav in this discussion. But make a teacher for yourself, and remove yourself from doubt. The obvious question is, so why does it need to say it twice? You could simply answer, Pirkei Avot, at this stage in Pirkei Avot, is simply recording that which various rabbis used to say and the advice they used to give. So it could be that multiple rabbis gave this advice. Certainly reasonable advice coming from a rabbi, Aseh Lecha Rav. However, the Rambam understands, and other commentators understand, that the first one is talking about how you learn Torah. So make sure you have a mentor, and make sure you have colleagues in your study as well. Whereas the second one is halachic guidance. Get a rabbi who will be your halachic guide, and thereby remove yourself from doubt. And it even continues to the last part of that Mishnah, which is that you shouldn't tithe by approximation. Even if you're going to say, well, I'll err on the side of adding, I'll be more strict. Nonetheless, what you're supposed to do is get proper halachic guidance. So this is the standard source for saying, get yourself a rabbi. There's another standard source we'll get to in a little bit. However, does this mean it has to be one rabbi? When it says, make a rabbi for yourself, who says it has to be one? Yes. And the basis for the obligation to doubt?
Because otherwise you're Muslim.
I don't know that I would assume that Muslims doubt. I'm going to question you. I wouldn't assume that Muslims don't doubt. But no, in all seriousness, without a doubt, so to speak, in the course of Jewish history, and even going back to Tanakh, we can find many, many examples of Jews doubting. However, a religion that is based entirely on a doubt, when you never come to conclusions, and you never decide, so this is what I'm going to do, or worse, you're never willing to take guidance from somebody else, is kindergarten. Right? If I'm going to spend my entire intellectual approach is going to be trying to poke holes and never accepting that someone else has something to say to teach me, to me it would and leave it at that. Yes.
But you can doubt from without.
Yeah. All true, but fundamentally, a person has to be willing to accept guidance, and that's, I think, the key message that we're getting from Pirkei Avot. But does this have to mean that it's going to be a single authority? I mean, it says Rav; it doesn't say Rabbanim, right? It says Rav singular.
How do we learn? We're going to be masking stuff because you want to look elsewhere, right? From the beginning.
I don't understand the question.
Does not ask an apparent source in the household
about. You're talking about when she's having trouble with the... Right, we don't actually know. In other words, we're not given the full conversation in that story. Well, let me offer you from Moshe Tzuriel in an article called Asela Charav. And if you flip the back of the packet just for a second, you'll see I gave you at the end bibliography of interesting articles that I found online that deal with the question of choosing a rabbi. So Rabbi Tzuriel's article is listed there together with the web link. The statement Rabbi Tzuriel makes, and he doesn't seem particularly concerned about making it, is that no, you can have more than one. It doesn't mean you have to have one. He says, "Va'ot pashud hu ki b'chol inyan onidon shonesh yesh b'harot yachol la'ashoel la'achlif min adam echad la'adam acher." He says it is obvious that for all the different topics that come up in the course of halachic rulings, the questioner is able to say, I'm going to ask this one, this, I'm going to ask that one, that, but kol shekein bizmaneinu, and he says, certainly in our day, she'eshnam rabbinim avakiyim v'charifim ma'od v'mektzoa achad, he says, sometimes you have rabbis who are particular experts in one area. He says, for example, the laws of what I may or may not do on Shabbos. So he's an expert on this area of law, but he's not necessarily going to be an expert on the agricultural mitzvahs of the land of Israel. So I'm not beholden to ask him all my questions in all the areas. I ask him where he is an expert. It's the age of specialization. Certainly nothing new for physicians. And that's his approach. Now, he goes further with it. It's a rather lengthy article. He points out that Rabbi Yosef Karo, in his Beis Yosef, talks about how he picks three great Rishonim, three great early halachic authorities, and more or less votes among them when he comes to his halachic decisions. However, when he writes his Shulchan Aruch, when he writes his Code of Jewish Law, he goes beyond those three. There are times where he takes an additional voice. So Rav Tzuriel takes that as evidence that you don't get locked into a particular rabbi, but rather there can be multiple rabbis whom you ask various questions. So that's in terms of the Aseh Lecha Rav source. Yes?
That example that you just gave is still different from saying, okay, so for questions of agriculture in the land of Israel, I'm going to ask Rabbi X, and I'm going to ask questions about Shabbos to Rabbi Y. The last example that you gave is actually saying, I'm going to ask multiple rabbis about the same question.
Right.
Which, like, I think that, you know, seems more problematic for somebody like,
yes,
if you're a common health practitioner, where, you know,
right,
I would assume that if they're going to Rabbi X about medical halacha, then once they decide that, then...
Right. So the truth is, Tzuriel's example in this case is not ideal for another reason, which is he's not dealing with people who are your rabbi. He's dealing with rabbis who wrote books centuries earlier. It's not a true asking your rabbi type of a question, as much as he's trying to establish a consensus among halachic authorities, and he's willing to go beyond his group of three. But I agree with you. I don't think it's an ideal example for this. He brought it, and I thought it was an interesting point, but I wouldn't use that as the sole basis for his statement. The other source, though, for asking a rabbi and choosing a rabbi does, at first glance, sound more like you have to pick a particular rabbi. And I think this speaks to our inherent discomfort with the idea of rabbi shopping. And take a look at source number 5. You'll see what I'm talking about. It's a Gemara in Erevin. It also appears in Rosh Hashanah Yudalit. I'm going to stop reading out of the Hebrew. I'm just going to go with the English in the interests of time, but I brought the Hebrew so that those who have it are able to see it. The Gemara in context is talking about the possibility of practicing competing stringencies, a stringency of the school of Hillel and a stringency of the school of Shammai. And so the Talmud asks, but would we really practice two stringencies? We've learned, quote, the law follows Beit Hillel, and one who wishes to follow Beit Shammai may do so, or Beit Hillel may do so. Following Beit Shammai's leniencies and Beit Hillel's leniencies is wicked. Following Beit Shammai's stringencies and Beit Hillel's stringencies, regarding such a person, Kohelet, right? The classic line in Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, says, and the fool walks in darkness. You're not supposed to pick all the stringencies. You're not supposed to pick all the leniencies. Rather, practice Beit Shammai's leniencies and stringencies, or Beit Hillel's leniencies and stringencies. So what they're establishing here is, pick one and go with it. Don't take the leniencies from both sides, and don't take the stringencies on both sides. Taking leniencies on both sides is wicked. Taking stringencies on both sides is foolish. Now, side note, it began by saying the law follows Beit Hillel. Why then does it say you can then follow Beit Shammai? So that's where I have the ellipsis there. That's where they discuss that and explain the source. But jumping to the point that's directly relevant for us, take a look at Rav Shizbi's conclusion. Rav Shizbi said, we don't follow the stringencies of two views where they contradict each other. If the two views contradict each other, then we don't follow the stringencies. If someone says, on this issue, I want to follow that rabbi, and he takes a strict point of view, and on that issue, I want to follow that rabbi, and he takes a strict point of view, that's legitimate, as long as the two aren't inherently contradictory. If the two are the results of opposing logic, then that makes no sense. That's foolish. And the same thing is true when it comes to leniencies. And Rashi spells it out on the top of the second side, source number 6. Rashi, commenting on this discussion where it appears in Rosh Hashanah, says, "Aval b'shtei machlokot, but in two disputes, where these are lenient in one, and these are lenient in the other one, there is neither wickedness nor foolishness. In this he agrees with Beit Shammai, and in this with Beit Hillel." In other words, if I study the views of multiple authorities in one particular area, and this one is the one that appeals to me and seems correct, and in this one I study the views of multiple authorities, and this one seems to be the one that's correct, or if I'm not a person who is of such caliber that I'm going to be able to choose, and I think, you know what, this one seems correct. I don't have the scholarship in that area. So I simply say, I'm asking this rabbi because he's the one who I know, and in this one I happen to see somebody, and I said, you know what, I'd like to ask him this question, and they give me two different answers, and their answers are both lenient. I am indeed entitled to follow both. That's what emerges from the Gemara here. As long as they are not inherently contradictory, it would seem I could follow both. So I'll give you an example, a medical example. Let's say, we discussed here a couple of months ago the topic of end-of-life care and the issue of giving up. And we noted multiple point of views, including the view of Rav Herschel Schachter, who is much more lenient in this regard than many others are. Right? I'm not going to go through the entire shiur now. But we saw a lenient stance regarding giving up and saying, I don't want to proceed with various types of care and various procedures. On the other hand, when it comes to the debate about defining the moment of death and accepting brain death or not, Rav Schachter is strict. He does not accept the standard of cessation of detectable neural function. So is somebody, you know, would somebody be allowed to say, when it comes to giving up, I'm adopting Rav Schachter's point of view. When it comes to the issue of determining time of death, I'm going to take Rabbi Kendler's view. There's something in us that feels like you can't do that. But based on what we're saying here, you absolutely can, because those two perspectives come from entirely different halachic discussions. You could reasonably maintain Rabbi Tendler's view on brain death and Rav Schachter's view on giving up, and there would be no contradiction between them. So that the argument that Rav Tzuriel puts forth, and again, I think it's a cogent argument, and I think it's very clear in Rashi here, is yeah, a person could legitimately have multiple authorities. Now, you have to, 1 second, two seconds actually, two caveats on this. Caveat number one is you have to know that they're not inherently contradictory. Right? What if I am not somebody who understands the discussions well enough to know whether these two views are contradictory or not? I don't know whether the brain death discussion overlaps with the giving up discussion. So then you may need to have one consistent authority to make sure that you're not making that mistake. The other caveat that I want to point out is that it may be wise to have one single halachic authority in order to run into these contradictory situations and in order to make sure that you have one approach. But that's really the same caveat, I suppose, just stated two different ways. But I think that I think that what Rav Tzuriel is saying is indeed correct. Yes?
Doesn't this approach allow for somebody who has made up his own mind as to what kind of answer he wants to go shopping around until he finds the point of view that he's willing to accept?
Right, and the answer seems to be yes. I mean, shopping around is something we have to get to when we talk about the second opinion issue. But right now, that's exactly what it sounds like. It sounds like if somebody calls me up and says, Rabbi, I have the following situation. And I know that if I call up Rav Schachter, I'm going to get one answer. And if I email Rabbi Dr. Abraham, I'm going to get a different answer. It sounds like from here, I am entitled to go with one view or to go with the other view. As long as I am consistent, and as long as I'm not going to one after going to the other, potentially, we have to talk about that. Now, the truth of the matter is, the way I framed it actually isn't precisely correct, because I added a nuance to it, right? I inserted the middleman into this conversation, where somebody came to me, and now I'm going to refer the question onward. It's one thing to say that an individual may not practice two competing leniencies, or should not be practicing two competing stringencies. But what about where the individual comes to somebody who says, well, I'm not an expert, I'm going to refer it onward. Maybe as long as you refer it to the same person for all of this person's questions, you're okay, even if when person X approaches me with that question, I'm going to go to this rabbi. When person Y approaches me, I'm going to go to that rabbi. It's possible to make the argument that as long as you're consistent as far as the questioner, you're allowed to be inconsistent as far as multiple questioners. You follow what I'm saying? I think that the argument could be made. I'm not sure, but I think it's an interesting possibility. But that's one point. But Suriel's point, yes?
Just a question you brought up. Like, if you look at those two different questions and take one answer from Rosh Schefter and the other one from Rabbi Tendler, and how do we know that there's no competing or contradicting thing there? Because they do seem similar, and so we have to make a judgment for ourselves.
Right, so you can't. And that's right. If someone doesn't know the sugya, then they're going to have to be consistent in who they ask. Yes, I think that's one of the points that militate in favor of having one rabbi you ask, is to guarantee that consistency. But it is possible to have this, for a person to have that knowledge and say, I looked through it, and no, they're coming from two different perspectives. They're coming from two different sets of sources, dealing with issues that don't overlap. But I want to add to Rav Tzuriel's point, and this is noted by a few sources, Aseh Lecha Rav, that Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, doesn't get quoted in any of the works of Halacha. There are many lines in Pirkei Avos that get quoted in the Rambam, in the Torah, in the Shulchan Aruch, our standard codes of law. Aseh Lecha Rav isn't one of them. You won't find a line in the Rambam that says, pick for yourself a rabbi. You won't find it in the Code of Jewish Law. Doesn't say it. And Rav Shlomo Aviner has a video which is titled Eich Bocharim Rav. You can find it online. It's a short video, a minute and 14 seconds. And he answers the question of how you choose a rabbi. And he says, it may be a good idea. It's productive to have one, but it's not an obligation. He's very straightforward with it. And I mentioned here, when we had the shiur on giving up, so I mentioned here Rav Schechter's guidance to me on this question. I had asked him that years and years earlier, he had given me guidance on a particular medical halacha question, saying I should ask Rabbi Dr. Abraham. And then, as I gained familiarity with the different positions of different rabbis, I realized he and Rabbi Dr. Abraham disagree on many issues. And so I asked him, sometimes I ask Rabbi Dr. Abraham because it's convenient, and I haven't bothered him recently, and sometimes I ask Rav Schechter because I haven't bothered him recently, and, is it okay that I'm doing that? And his answer was, as long as the halachic authority you ask is a Yirei Shamayim, is somebody who has awe of heaven and is approaching things properly, so yeah, that's okay. So I think this is why he said that's okay. I have to ask him now. This is his logic. But I think that I think this is why, because fundamentally, Aseh Lecha Rav, make a rabbi for yourself, is good advice. But not necessarily something that says every Jew has to pick a rabbi and that's it. So what we're saying here is that there may be the possibility of asking multiple rabbis your questions. It may not be a good idea, both from a halachic standpoint and from just a personal standpoint. And we'll see some of that when we talk about how one chooses a rabbi. One of the aspects is you want someone who knows you. And, if you start asking multiple rabbis, it's hard to develop that kind of association. But more, there is another problem, and that brings us to our next subtopic. And that is the obligation to follow an authority who already has a claim on you, not under Aseh Lecha Rav, but as Mara D'Asra, as the rabbi of the area. Literally, Mara D'Asra means rabbi of the land, although we may modify that as we go through this. The Gemara in Shabbos, source number 7, is one of many sources in the Gemara which indicate that a local rabbi has authority, even if the rest of the halachic world disagrees with him. take a look, please. It comes up in the context of a discussion about preparing a knife for a bris milah on Shabbos. We know that bris milah overrides Shabbos. What about the backup steps to prepare for a bris milah? So Rabbi Eliezer takes the stance that all backup steps may be performed to the point where you can make the knife on Shabbos. He says you are allowed to make coals in order to prepare the iron for the circumcision knife on Shabbos, and nobody else agrees with him, but where he lived, that's what they did. And further, still in source number 7, in the place of Rabbi Yossi Aglili, you should say Yossi, not Yosef, they ate poultry and milk. Rabbi Yossi Aglili disagreed with the rabbinic prohibition against poultry and milk. And so there, they had the chicken parmesan or whatever it is that they would want to have. They did it. And they tell the story of Levi going to the home of Yosef the trapper, and they bring him the head of Tavta, which is some kind of a bird, in milk. And he doesn't eat it. He comes to Rebbe. Rebbe says, he gave you that? He gave you the bird and the milk? Why didn't you excommunicate him? And he said, because I knew that was Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira's land. And it could be that there they follow the teaching of Rabbi Yossi Aglili. And that's why I didn't speak up. Because I thought maybe, you know what? It's his area. That's what they do there. And there are numerous Gemaras with passages like this authorizing the rabbi of the area to take that kind of a stance, even against the world. It is brought, I gave you here, the Rashba in source number 8. Number 8 is a key source in this entire discussion. It's one of the main sources for the question of how one chooses a rabbi, must one choose a rabbi, and so forth. And he writes, if there is one rabbi in their place and he has taught them, he is the one who has taught them Torah, they follow his words. And along these lines, whenever they follow one of the leading authorities for all of their deeds, where they follow Rif's halachot for all of their deeds, the Rif being deceased for a very long time before you get to the Rashba's time. So when they follow the Rif for all of his deeds, or they follow Rambam's composition for all of their deeds, they have made these giants as their rabbis. If you pick a textbook and you say, this is our textbook and this is what we follow for all halachic opinions, then that's what you go with. However, if there is a sage there who is worthy of ruling and he sees reason to prohibit what they permit, then they must follow the prohibition. Okay, he says, if you have these books, and these books are your textbooks, then that's what you follow. But if you have the textbooks that say X, and then you have a rabbi who's actually alive, who's there in the community, and he says Y, and he's somebody who's worthy of issuing rulings, then they must follow the prohibition. These texts are not like their actual rabbis. It's not the same thing. If they would follow the dissenter's view in the place of their actual rabbi, they would take his honor lightly in his place, which you can't do. So I want to come back to the point about honor. But what Rashba is saying is that the rabbi you choose to follow, you say, this is my authority, overrides rabbis elsewhere who may say something that is different. I brought you a similar source in number 9 from the Ran, Rabbeinu Nisim, in which he says, people from one place are obligated to follow their giant's words, even where the majority disagree with them. So this tells us there is such a thing as the authority of the Mara de Asra, the rabbi of the community. It is brought by Rabbi Moshe Isserles by the Rama in source number 10, where he writes, Im hayayachid neged rabim, where it is one against many, holchemacha rabim b'chol makom, we follow the many everywhere in all areas. However, if there is a local custom of leniency because a sage ruled thus, then we follow his view. Where there is a custom to say, this is what the local authority has said, that is indeed what we are going to follow. So this is considered to be law, the obligation to follow the local authority. I should note that the Pri Chadash commenting on Shulchan Aruch says that maybe the local authority should consider giving in to the majority. In other words, it's all well and good for everybody to say, my rabbi says X, I don't care the whole world says Y, but maybe he should consider the fact that the whole world disagrees with him. That may be relevant. Why is it that the local authority would have this kind of sway? Yes?
Yeah.
Sorry?
In this source, it just says if there's a local custom of leniency, the hakel for somebody who wants to make them.
Right. Oh, I think just because of the context of the case. That's all. In other words, looking at his discussion, looking at Ramah overall, there in Shulchan Aruch, it's in the context that he ends up saying we need to. The same thing will be true for the stringency. Yeah. Yes?
How does this apply in the current world when we have Reform and conservative Judaism?
Right. So we have to get to that question. It's coming. The first, why should there be any authority to the local rabbi? We just talked about how Aseh L'Charav isn't even quoted in Shulchan Aruch, isn't even quoted in the Rambam. Why would there be any authority to the local rabbi? Yeah, Sheldon and then David.
He would know the local situation, which might differ from somewhere else.
Okay, so he's more aware of what the needs are locally.
I was going to say something like that, but from the Bill McDonough's approach to Tzak in general, that he doesn't believe in going to Tiskei Shilas and Shubas. He says there's always a subtext that was never written in. So whoever gave this psak, there was a particular person. So let's say it was a shiloh with a chicken as a kosher nut. So there may be, the Rav knows that there's a ground for leniency, there are also grounds for more stringent. So if it's a poor person who might not be able to afford another chicken for Shabbos, you do the lenient position. And for a wealthy person, it doesn't matter to the stringency. But that's not written into the...
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
he says you have to do it on the basis of the sugya and rishonim, and so that would be known. So,
right, so that's really a separate question.
But the relation is that the local rav knows about the local situation, whereas one congregation might have some unique characteristics,
right?
Which
right. No, what you're saying is an extension of Sheldon's. I think it is saying that you need somebody who knows the specifics and therefore will be able to draw the proper analogies and the proper precedents because they know the specifics of the situation. Eddie, and then
you want to have unity.
Is unity the ideal?
I think so. You'd rather be on the local.
Okay, unity over strife. Yeah.
Well, what you're saying is exactly in contradiction to what you said just a little earlier.
That's okay. Yeah.
You might have a local rabbi who doesn't know a whole lot about it, as an example, know a lot about medical issues.
Right.
On the other hand, you may have somebody who really is an expert on medical issues.
Right. So, good. All of these are valid points. I'm going to come back to your question in a couple of minutes, along with the question of what happens today with the profusion of different approaches. So there are actually no fewer than 6 different halachic arguments for the power of Mara D'Atra, and each one matters because they change your conclusions. So the first 2 come under the heading of disagreeing with the local rabbinic authority is an attack on him personally, because he's the one who's there. And that comes under 2. There are two sub-arguments there. The first one is what the Rashba already said in source number 8 at the end, when he talked about honor. The issue is the honor of the rabbi. When you have somebody there who is an established sage, and he's the one who teaches everybody, and you say, I'm not going to follow him, I want to go ask somebody else, that is a direct insult. Now, we live in an age in which people are cool with that. You know, the idea of insulting people is a mark of honor. You know, it shows that I'm an independent thinker. However, we have a law of Kavod HaTorah. We have such a concept as respect for the Torah. And no, you're not allowed to just say, well, I want to insult people. That's no good. You can't insult people in general, and you can't insult Torah. So this is a bad combination. That's number 1. Number 2, and I brought you the Rashba, so you can see that there. Number 2, from source number 11, Rabbi Chiyo Michal Epstein talks about the problem of Parnassa, the problem of his financial survival, meaning that, as he writes, rabbis in the contemporary age are supported by the community for their roles as rabbi, and in the event that you're going to undermine him by going somewhere else, or in his context, he's talking about the other rabbi who sets himself up to answer questions locally, then that's called Hasagas Gevul. He's undermining the financial survival of the rabbi involved. Now, you may ask, well, if he isn't competent, then maybe he deserves that. But that's not what we're assuming. We're assuming that he is competent. We have to talk about the case where he's not. But those are the first 2 points. The first 2 points come under the heading of, it's an attack on him. The second two points deal with the community and how potentially going to other authorities can undermine things from a communal perspective. And again, there are two different ways to look at this. Number one is the community has accepted this authority. And we view it as almost like a neder, almost like a vow that the community has taken that we are going to accept the words of this this rabbinic authority. If you take a look at source number 12, the Tashbetz, Rabbi Shimon ben Tzemach Duran says, if one violates his words, meaning the words of the rabbi, and one asks, and he goes and asks a rabbi and says, will you give me permission to violate that? And is given license to violate his rabbi's words. The license is no license, and he is excommunicated. This may be compared to a city where they accept the words of a rabbi. One who permits against him is excommunicated. He starts with an individual's case, then he moves to the communal. And he says, you can't do it. If you accept somebody, that person's word is then binding as the last word. And that's something you find in halachic authorities down through the ages, that there's a principle of you're supposed to appoint judges, you're supposed to appoint leaders, and when you appoint them, they are the ones who you are bound to follow. Rav Moshe Feinstein brought it, and numerous others did. I chose not to bring you the whole list of sources. Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch had the issue in his community in Frankfurt, and he wrote very strongly about this issue. It's in Shemesh Marpe, Nun Beis, Rav Shaul Yisraeli and Amud Haimini Vav, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Igros Moshe Yeridea Gimel Ayin, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein wrote about this. There is an obligation in which you say, you accepted this person, so the community has accepted the person, and therefore the members of the community are bound to follow it. There's a separate issue which goes back to what Eddie pointed out, which is the challenge of splitting the community. The Torah says, Perek Yudalet Pasuk Aleph in Devarim, Banim Atem Lashem Elokeichem, you are chosen to Hashem your God, Lo Sis Go Didu, do not cut yourselves. And there are numerous lessons that are learned from that. Some of them are in terms of not cutting one's skin, self-mutilation, but there's also a prohibition against national self-mutilation in which we split ourselves into various groups. So take a look at the Rambam in source number 13, it's the top of the third side, where he writes, this prohibition of do not cut yourselves includes having two courts in one city, this one acting this way, that one acting another way. This causes great strife. And he quotes you the pasuk, do not cut yourselves, do not become groups and groups. Oh, now we have two cameras. We're not supposed to damage community. We're supposed to try to pursue a uniform practice, and it's brought in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. I brought you in source number 14. There are, again, many sources that one could bring on this issue. Of Chaim of Volozhin wrote in the Keter Rosh, division of practice leads to division of hearts. It causes strife in the community. Rav Chaim David Alevi and Mayim Chaim Aleph Ayin Aleph. There are many, many sources on this. So that we have one concern, which is not to attack the rabbi who's local. We have another, which says community is important. Whether community in the sense that you accept him, you go with him, or whether in the sense that you'll cause strife between different people. And then finally, there's a third school of thought, which also has two sub-schools, which says that's not the way Psak works. That's not the way halachic rulings work. The way halachic rulings work is that there is an authority locally, and he's the one who you are supposed to follow. Rabbi Yom Tov Elazvili, the Ritvan, source number 15, connects it to the Torah's sentence of Los Sasur. You're not supposed to stray. You go to the judge who is there in those days, and Los Sasur, you don't stray from after his words. Rabbi Yaakov Epstein, in his Chevel Nahalaso, in source number 16, offers a different take on the same concept, and he says, for a person to rule when he has a rabbi in the city is mora halacha bifnei rabbo. That's giving a ruling in front of one's rabbi, and that is indeed prohibited. So we have different schools of thought. You have one school of thought that says the reason why you need to follow the mara de asra is because disagreeing would be an attack on him. You have the school of thought that says disagreeing would undermine the community, and then you have the school of thought that says disagreeing is not legitimate as halacha. You're not allowed to stray. You're from after the words of the rabbi who guides you. You're not allowed to issue rulings in the place where your rabbi is, and that's what you'd be doing by pursuing a different approach. So I'm going to make a long story short on this topic because we could spend forever just on this. But I want to say that there are practical differences between these reasons. And those touch on some of the questions that have already been asked here. First question, that wasn't asked here, but I think it's an important one. What if the rabbi hasn't voiced a view on this particular topic? Right? What if someone wants to get a kidney transplant, and the rabbi never spoke about kidney transplants, or wants to donate a kidney, or somebody wants to, whatever it is, fill in the blank, but the rabbi has never spoken on the topic. Is there an obligation to go to the rabbi and open up the can of worms, asking him the question? Or maybe then you can say, well, I never heard him speak about this, so I can go to somebody else. So it's going to depend on which reason I take. If I take the reason of the community has accepted him, that's fine. I'm not unaccepting him. He hasn't spoken on the topic. If I take the rationale of disagreeing with him will be an attack on him, I don't know whether I disagree with him or not. However, if the issue is you can't paskin differently, you have to follow the rabbi, then maybe there is an imperative to say that you have to ask him. It depends on which one is your source. Or this is an important one. What if the Mara d'Asra doesn't care? What if he says, I'm fine with people going anywhere. I don't consider myself the last word on the topic. Let's say he says, I'm not an expert in medical halacha. I don't know that field so well. Go ahead and ask whoever you wish to ask. The Gemara in Kiddushin, Daf Lamed Beis, says, Harav shemachal kvodo, kvodo machul. That if the rabbi forgives his honor, it is forgiven. It's not as though you are obligated to be more respectful of him than he is of himself. If he says, go ask somebody else, then maybe the answer is you would be allowed to go ask somebody else. Under the heading of disagreeing would be an attack on him, it certainly would not be an attack whatsoever. So maybe you'd be allowed to go elsewhere. Jeffrey, I'm going to ask you to hold it, please, because I have a whole list of these that I think people are waiting on. What if the patient comes from somewhere else? But the doctor is local, right? You have a big hospital, University of Toronto, or whatever it is. You have a big medical center. Someone comes from somewhere else to be treated here, and there's a halachic question that the doctor has about how to treat this patient. Do you go with the patient's rabbi from back home? Do you go with a local authority here? Well, it's being done here, and the division in the community would be here. But on the other hand, if you're talking about his personal rabbi, maybe it's the patient's personal rabbi who's going to matter. Does the Mara d'Asra exist at all today? When multiple communities coexist, when there are multiple schools of thought and everybody is aware of those multiple schools of thought simultaneously, when people consult multiple halachic authorities based on multiple books, maybe there's no such thing as Mara d'Asra at all today. So again, that's going to depend on which way I take Mara d'Asra. If I take it as the community accepted him, then the community accepted him regardless of, and community doesn't have to mean everybody within the locale, but everybody who identifies as part of that community has accepted this person as their authority, and therefore maybe that's considered to be sufficient. On the other end, if I say that the problem is don't split into multiple communities, cat's out of the bag on that one. We're already split anyway, so he's not part of this community, he's part of a different community. It all depends on what the rationale for Mara d'Asra really is. And the same thing is true for the question that was asked. What if he's not considered an expert on that area of halacha? What if he thinks he is? But you don't consider him to be an expert. He doesn't know everything on this topic, and you want to go to somebody else. So it will undermine the community. I think you have to accept that. And it is a concern for this being an attack on him. So I think it really matters on which of these you accept. I'm not posturing on what the reason is for Mara d'Asra. I'm presenting you a list of all of these different ones. I think it's possible that more than one of these is valid. It's important to note, though, we're not saying the Mara d'Asra is always right. We're not saying that because he said it, that turns it, that converts it into, you know, the ruling. What we're saying is that there are a variety of reasons why you would have to follow him, even if, from a purely objective standpoint, his approach is not the only way to read the sources. And I think that's a key thing to understand. I would like to be able to take questions on this, but there's so much more to see that I'm going to ask you to hold questions on this to the end. There's a lot that can be said with it. But I want to note for you, in particular, source number 17 from Aviron Lichtenstein, where he notes that Mara Da'asra doesn't mean the authority in that physical location necessarily. He says, the definition of the relevant community, however, is murky. The Gemara speaks of locale, but it seems strange that geography should be the sole determinant. Would an enclave of Judean emigres in Galilee be permitted to eat chicken fried in butter? Right? The ruling of Rabbi Yossi Aglili that we mentioned earlier. Would only residents of 12th century Egypt be entitled to rely upon the Rambam's minority kulot, the Rambam's leniencies? It seems far more likely that other factors, ethnic identity, or above all, spiritual and ideological fealty, should carry no less weight. I believe this is clearly suggested by the Rashba, which we saw earlier. So it's not only about the rabbi of my place. It can also be rabbi of the community with whom I identify. And so, going back to your question, if I follow, let's say, the example, I'm going to use the example that Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein gave. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein wrote this article when Rabbi Soloveitchik was still alive. So he said, if I follow the positions of Rabbi Soloveitchik generally, it doesn't matter where I live. It doesn't matter if I live where he is, if I go to his shiur, or if I live somewhere around the world. But if I follow his positions in general, then he is my Mara D'Asra, so to speak. Even though the word Asra will obviously be a misnomer. So the question of, is there a binding authority that goes with the rabbi of the community, and will that apply today, is really going to depend on the way that we look at where Mara D'Asra comes from. And that's really what I want to emerge from this section with, that key point. It really depends on whether this is about the unity of the community, which is of limited application today when people do in fact go many different places. Is it about it being a slight for the rabbi in some sense? Is it undermining him, or is it a slight to his honor? Or is it that you can't because he is your rabbi and therefore you don't have a right to issue your own rulings against him or to pursue other rulings? I will note, though, one other point, which goes back to what David and Sheldon said. I'm a strong believer, as I think I've made clear to pretty much everybody in this room at one point or another, I'm a strong believer in the idea of Mara D'Asra having nothing to do with this, but having to do with the fact that you need an authority who knows you and who knows the community. And realistically, if I'm going to go running here, there, and everywhere for guidance on things, I'm going to completely lose that personal aspect of it. And I think that's a very dangerous thing. There's a sense, not only that, there's a sense of professional responsibility that comes with being the Mara D'Asra. If you can ask Twitchiner what he thinks about this topic and about that topic and the other topic, and he has no responsibility back to you because he's not the rabbi of the community, then you're not going to get the same type of an answer that you're going to get from someone who, at the end of the day, has to answer to the community. And I think that's very important as well. That's in terms of Mara D'Asra. But let's go to the other end of the spectrum. We have halachic texts, all sorts of books that have been written of medical halacha. There is the Nishmas Avram, there are the Asya journals, there are various books of medical ethics, there are tshuvos, there are responsa that are written. Do we say, maybe we can say, you can just go to the answers that are seen in books. The truth of the matter is that we have a very long history, older than the printing press, of honoring sfarim, of honoring texts as halachic resources. This is a very, very old thing. If you take a look at source number 18, Rav Aharon HaKohen, writing in 14th century France, quotes from the Balei HaTosfos, authors of the Tosfos in the 13th century, Rabbi Shmuel of Evro and his brother Rabbi Moshe of Evro. Listen to this. Rabbi Shmuel of Evro, mentor of Rabbeinu Yonah, and his brother, wrote in their letters, Since our ancestors were exiled and our temple was destroyed and the lands were confused and the teachings and hearts were reduced, we no longer say awe for your teacher should be like awe of heaven, and all of the laws of the student-rabbi relationship are void. Everything you see in the Talmud, in the Gemara, about the respect that the student has to have for the Rebbe and so forth, he says, forget it. They no longer apply. For the Gemara and commentaries and novelties and compositions are what guide people, and all is, shouldn't be novelty, it should be novelle, and all is according to the wisdom of hearts. He says, at this point, we rule based on our books. We have books, and we figure out how to apply them to a particular situation, and the book becomes the Rebbe. And that's not unique to these couple of authors, the Rav Shmuel of Evro and his brother Moshe of Evro. Take a look at source number 19. The Lechem Mishnah writing on of the Rambam asks the question of why the Rambam omits the Talmudic statement that you're not allowed to issue halachic rulings until you are 40 years old. The Rambam omits that. Why does the Rambam omit it? Lechem Mishnah suggests in source number 19, it appears to me to explain our master's view that he believes that the Talmudic limitation of 40 years is about wisdom, because of Rava's statement that one cannot understand his rabbi's view for 40 years. And our master, meaning the Rambam, thought that this was only in earlier times when they learned only from teachers, not books. This is seen in the way Rava learned it from Moshe, who learned orally from God. But now that Torah is written and we learn from books, we certainly do not need that much time. He says, we don't learn the same way. We're learning out of textbooks, and therefore, it's a different story altogether. And Rabbi Moshe Isserles, in source number 20, notes the existence of what he calls chiburim, compositions, that indeed become accepted as the source for halacha. So much so that Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, the Shmuz Yaakov, writing in the 19th century, says, a rabbi who gives halachic rulings without consulting the texts is called mora halacha bifnei rabo. He is guilty of issuing a halachic ruling without consulting his rebbe, because the books qualify as your mentor. So on this basis, I'm showing you a chain of sources that seem to say you can go with the textbooks. Is that really sufficient? And the answer is not necessarily, because of the point that Dr. Nussbaum pointed out before. I brought it here in source number 21. There's an excellent, very long, but excellent article by Rabbi Binyamin Zaltzman, Rabbi Gorfinkel, in source number 21, I gave you a link for it in the bibliography, in which they talk about the obligation of taking counsel with others before issuing a halachic ruling. And is it an obligation? Where does it come from? Where is it binding? And so forth. But they note here the fundamental problem with ruling from texts. He says, or they say, in truth, taking counsel from books as a replacement for taking counsel with a sage is not simple at all. We have already emphasized that there are many who believe that a judge must take counsel regarding comparisons of cases through which he wishes to come to a ruling, even though he has asked about a similar comparison in the past. In other words, if you want to say the case in front of me looks like X, you better check with somebody else to make sure they think it looks like X also. If you're going to go from books, you know, there's a problem with books. They don't give you feedback. You say, in this text, it looks like this case is parallel to what I am seeing in front of me. But you don't know that it is. And therefore, there's an obligation to check with others to make sure that you're not doing this incorrectly. And on that basis, I say that, yes, the textbooks are valuable, but the person shouldn't make the mistake of saying, I'm going to make that leap myself and say, I think the case in front of me is just like that. You go to somebody who has some experience with this, because you will find that there are people out there who will look at things differently and who may have some experience that indicates that you should go in a different direction, as opposed to saying, I am confident in my own understanding. Yes, it's important for a person to have a sense of self. Yes, it's important for a person to study and to build himself up and to build up his understanding. But it's not the same thing as saying, and therefore I don't need anybody else's help. I can do this myself. That's on the books question. What about seeking a second opinion? So again, this is a topic that admits of many subtopics and is a very challenging topic to deal with. I'm trying to make a long story short with it. In source number 22, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah is our key source that we have to start with. Our sages taught the following. One who asks a sage who declares an item impure may not ask another sage who will declare it pure. Once you've asked one, you're stuck. One who asks a sage who prohibits may not ask another sage who will permit it. If he asks two sages simultaneously, and one declares it impure and the other pure, one prohibits, one permits, say if one is greater, so that's who you follow. Otherwise, follow the stricter view is the initial point, and then Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha says it's not true. It depends if it's biblical or rabbinic. You have a doubt about a biblical matter, you go strictly. You have doubt about a rabbinic matter, you go leniently. And Rabbi Yosef said the law follows Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. So this is the source for saying that you have to go with the rabbi you asked, that you don't get to ask a second opinion. Why would I not be allowed to ask a second opinion? So again, if we had unlimited time, I would make this a discussion. I apologize for not doing so. But there are three different approaches that are brought classically to why you shouldn't ask a second opinion. One approach is, and this is the approach I brought you, the Ritva, it's also the approach of the Ravid, is to say that the problem is, we ask somebody his point of view. If he prohibits, that makes it into a prohibited item. And there are different explanations for how that works. The most simple is, when you ask somebody, it's like you're taking a vow. I'm going to follow this person's advice. And at that point, whatever you hear from somebody else afterwards is irrelevant. They can't reverse that. That's one school of thought. Second school of thought, which I brought you in source number 24 from the Ran, it's also brought in the Ritva in 23, is that it's about honor. You asked him the question. He gave you an answer. Now you're going to go around town saying, I'd like to ask other people. That's disrespectful. And then the third approach is the approach is also is brought by the Ran, and that is the appearance of two different Torot. In source number 24, he mentions, there's a concern that you're going to make it look like there are two different Torahs. Look, you have this one, and you have this one, and I went to this one, he said this, and go to that one, he's going to say that. And it's damaging to the community. Which approach you take changes your conclusion. There are practical differences between these approaches. For example, if it's all about the honor of that first rabbi, or the appearances of two Torot, then, you know, I'm going to hold off on this one. I'm going to hold off on this. I'm going to say a different application. What if I was just getting information? What if I go to the first rabbi, never intending that this should be psak? I'm getting a sense of what rabbis think about this. So I go to the first one and I say, what do you think about? In that case, if the issue is you made it prohibited by asking him, I didn't, because I never intended for this to be psak. If, however, the issue is disrespect or causing multiple views within the community, then it doesn't matter what my thinking was. I'm not allowed to ask somebody else. What if I get permission from the first rabbi to ask another one? I asked him his opinion. He said to me, I think you can't do it. I said to him, oh boy, can I ask somebody else? He says, yeah, go ahead. That's okay. So again, if I take the view that it's about his honor, it's not. He forgave his honor. We learned you can forgive your honor. But if the issue is that you, by asking, have made this binding on yourself, then too bad. What if the second sage I ask is greater than the first? So then, there's no diminution of the honor of the first one by asking someone who's acknowledged to be greater. But on the other hand, in terms of creating the appearance of two Torahs in the community, that still will be a problem. What if the first one... Well, let me leave out that one also. So the question then is, what is the halacha in this? Do we really say you are not allowed to ask a second authority? So here's a very funny thing. The Rambam omits it. The Rambam omits this discussion about if you ask one, you may not ask the other. And there's a lot of discussion about why the Rambam omits it. The Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, in his commentary to the Tur, does mention it, and says the issue is about the honor of the rabbi, but he doesn't bring it in Shulchan Aruch. He doesn't bring it in the code of Jewish law, perhaps because of the honor of the Rambam, who didn't mention it, so therefore he's not going to mention it at all. Rama is the one who mentions it. Rabbi Moshe Isserles mentions it, and his language seems to be that he believes that it's about the fact that you ask the question making the item prohibited. But he says a few things that are very important to note. If you take a look at source number 26, he says some key things. And this goes back to your question about questioning, actually. He says, if a sage prohibits, another cannot permit due to his own thinking, unless he has a tradition that the former sage erred. And that's based on a case in the Gemara in which a woman went to one rabbi with a question and then went to another rabbi and got a different answer because the other rabbi had a different tradition. And that's a story in its own right, but that's the basis for what Rabbi Isserles says. So that's number one. He says, if you have a tradition that the first rabbi made a mistake, you are allowed to go to the second one. Or where there was a mistake in a textual matter, what we call a Dvar Mishnah, a fundamental error, then, once again, he could permit, the second sage could permit. And even where the first sage erred just in his thinking, in his logic, so it's very subjective, one may debate with the authority until he recants. Therefore, there is no prohibition against asking a second sage, so long as he informs him that the first one prohibited. You have to let him know what the first one said, but then go ahead, ask the second opinion. You are allowed to have a dispute in that regard. And even where the first one permitted and his ruling was binding, the second cannot permit. I'm sorry, it should say prohibit, I believe. Let me check my Hebrew. Yeah, the second one may not prohibit due to his thinking. He says, don't think that it's only prohibitions that are binding. Permissions are also binding. If one sage said, mutter, you're not allowed to then come along and say, usser, unless, again, you have a difference in thinking and you argue it and eventually come to a conclusion. But then he says something that blows the lid off of this entire discussion. And I think this is very important to know, the last line of Ramah. He says, all of this is only regarding the actual ruling. But in another case, it is obvious that one may rule as he sees fit. In other words, what that means is the following. I have a case in which a woman comes to me and says, I need to have a hysterectomy. So that involves halachic issues. So I go to the rabbi and say, Rabbi, may this be done? Or you know what, that's actually not even a good question for a reason I'll come back to in a second. Let me ask the question differently. I'm going to ask a kashrus question. The question to the rabbi is, here's the chicken, it was shechted, I see this thing inside of it, I don't know if it's kosher or treif. And I go to the rabbi. The rabbi says, that chicken is treif. Then, the next day, I have another chicken. And the chicken has what seems to be the same thing. Or somebody else has another chicken that seems to have the same thing. They're not bound by the rabbi's ruling on my chicken. Because that is, the ruling is case specific. Each case gets asked separately, and you are allowed, therefore, to take it to somebody else. The reason I changed from the hysterectomy case is because there isn't even an item, so to speak. The question is about an action, not about an item. And so it's clear it won't apply beyond the people who are involved because it's about whether I can do something, not about an entity in and of itself. So what Rama is teaching me is very important here. He says, number one, you're allowed to argue. Okay, this goes back to your point. The rabbi gives you a ruling. Yes, there's an issue of respect for him. Yes, there is an issue of not creating divisions in the community and so on. But if you think there's a mistake, then say so. And debate it out. That's number one. He says there's nothing wrong with doing it, and further, there's nothing wrong with going to another rabbi and asking him the question that way and seeing what he's going to say as long as you inform him what the first one said. That's number one. Number two is that it's only where the question was about that entity. That's when it is binding. Not otherwise. And I think that's a second key point. And it's based on a Rashba in Chulin Mem Daled. The last point I want to make on this, though, is an answer given by the Minchas Usher, Rav Usher Weiss. It's in Chilek Beis of his Chuvos, Volume 2. It's number 60. And he was asked a question by somebody. I went to the rabbi with my question. The rabbi was really busy. He didn't have a lot of time to look into it. He said, yeah, you shouldn't do it. Does that constitute a psak, such that now I'm not able to ask somebody else? Is that binding on me? And Rav Weiss's answer, which I think intuitively we know, certainly the way I phrased it already gives it away, is no, that's not a psak. When we say if you asked one, you're not supposed to ask another, we're talking about where it was properly investigated and thought through, and this is the answer. Not where it was, you know what, better not to. That's not a that's not a psak. That's a suggestion. That's I think, very important to recognize. I'm going very quickly. Is this somewhat clear, or I feel like I'm throwing maybe a little too much out here? What we've said so far in a couple of nutshells is, number one, I'm not necessarily obligated to pick a particular posek. The idea of Aseh L'Charav doesn't necessarily mean one rabbi, and doesn't certainly, if I'm taking two different views that are not mutually contradictory, I'm fine. And I say the Harav doesn't make it into the Rambam, and it doesn't make it into the Shulchan Aruch. So that's number one. Number two, there is a halachic authority that comes with being the Mara D'Asra, the rabbi of the location or community, even ideological community, as we talked about. It stems from either concern for, respect for that authority, or concern for the unity of the community, or the fact that the community accepted him and therefore they're bound by him, or because you can't issue halachic rulings against your Rebbe. We noted some differences between those views and applications to contemporary questions. You're not able to rely solely on what you see in books. Even though we recognize halachic authority in books, nonetheless, they are not the be-all and end-all. And you have to worry about potentially drawing incorrect comparisons to what you see in a text. And then finally, you're not supposed to ask a second opinion in general. However, in the event that you think that there's a mistake, you are allowed to go back to the original and debate it. You're allowed to go to a second one and ask that question as long as you inform him of what the first one said. And the ruling of the first one is only binding in terms of that specific case at hand and not in terms of extrapolation. I'm going to move to the last issue that we have, and I'll stick around to answer questions. I'm not running out, but this is the one which triggered the whole shiur. And that is, what traits should a doctor seek in a rabbi? So some places that I looked, you know, just sort of gave very simple advice, right? You know, sort of along the lines of chacham, right? A sage, yirei shamayim, God-fearing, somebody with good midos, somebody who behaves properly. Yeah, and these are true. But there are real questions beyond that. It has to be somebody with a knowledge of those sparim, those texts that we mentioned before. We talked about those texts being important. You do have to know them. However, that knowledge may be less important today than having a sharp mind. This goes back to a Gemara at the end of Brachos. It also appears in Harios. I brought it as source number 28. In which they debated, is it better to be a Sinai, meaning you know the breadth of Torah, or an Oker Harim, somebody who can uproot mountains and grind them together and get at the fine points of logic? And in that debate, early authorities ruled that in fact it's better to be a Sinai. Sinai trumps. The Reb Magash, the Machzor Vitri from the students of Rashi, seem to indicate that it's better to be a Sinai. Even Rabbi Yosef Ta'oim, author of Prima Gadim in source number 29, said that when it comes to who you give an aliyah to, you have a choice between a Sinai and an uprooter of mountains, Sinai comes first. That's considered to be greater. However, we live in a different age. Why do we live in a different age? What changed? Printing press, and then? Internet, CD-ROMs, databases, searchable databases. We live in a very different world in terms of accessibility of information. At this point, there's a flood of information you can find on any topic you like. The challenge is to figure out what's correct, to be able to distill it, and to have that clarity of perception that will enable somebody to say, this is what you should be looking at. Those other sources are not what you should be looking at. And so the truth is, the priorities may indeed change. This actually is an old concern. I brought you source number 30. It was too late at night, and I had too many other things I had to do, and I didn't translate the full source for number 30. That's the only one I didn't. But it's a great source and very worth reading for those who have the Hebrew for it. But what the Sifri says, and what Rabbeinu Asher says in source number 30, and the key point that I wanted to distill from it, is that he says, anybody who just says, well, I'm going to rule based on the Rambam, is making a mistake. You have to know the original source. Remember, there is no Shulchan Aruch in the Rosh's day. It was generations away. But he says, those who think they're just going to rule from the Rambam are making a mistake. You have to know the source. You have to know the Gemara. You have to be able to figure it out. You need to use logic. And that certainly becomes an issue the closer you get to our own day, that we may need more the Oker Harim, the rabbi who has really a sharp mind. So we've said you need to have knowledge of the books, but the sharp mind is critical. You also need, and this cannot be overstated, there's no way to overstate it, it's too great an issue. The issue of Shimush Talmidei Chachamim. It has to be somebody who has apprenticed to Torah scholars, who knows not just what he read in books, but who has seen the way questions are answered, the way that cases are taken apart, the way that people, human beings, are addressed. If you take a look at source number 31, a biting comment from the Talmud, one who has read and studied, but not apprenticed with Torah scholars, Rabbi Eliezer says, this is an Am Haaretz. Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani said, this is a boor. Boor in Aramaic, boor in English, same thing for our purposes. Rabbi Yannai said, this is a kuti, and what he means by that is somebody who does not take rabbinic teaching seriously. Rav Achav Bar Yaakov said, this is a trickster, because he gets a good reputation for scholarship, but he doesn't actually have what it takes to be a proper authority. So it has to be somebody who has apprenticed to Torah sages. It also has to be someone who asks questions to evaluate practical cases. And this is one where medicine, I think, comes into play in particular. Has to be somebody who's going to ask questions to find out what's going on medically. There's an interesting article in a book called Medicine and Jewish Law. It's a collection of essays. This is volume 2 by Dr. Marshall Kielsen, in which he compares different rabbis' view approach with questions to the different, to the four kids in the Haggadah. And so there's one category he has for the Eino Yodei Elish Ol, who doesn't ask questions. He simply tells you, yeah, this is what you should do. And he's clearly very against that. But it is true. It's critical to make sure that you ask somebody who is going to investigate and is going to ask proper questions about it. It has to be somebody who understands the case at hand. It also has to be somebody who consults authorities. And this goes back to the article I mentioned for Rabbi Zaltzman and Rabbi Gorfinkel about making sure that you consult with others. There are great sources on this within the Gemara itself. Pirkei Avos in source number 32. Rabbi Yishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, says, the last line of what he writes, one who is arrogant about ruling is foolish, wicked, and arrogant. Source number 33, perhaps even more clear, they're talking about a pasuk which speaks of tokim. To be tokea doesn't mean to blow a shofar in this context. It means to press something in hard, to stab something in. So one who is tokea himself to halacha is criticized in that Gemara in Yevamos, and the Gemara explains what that means. This refers to a judge who has a case come before him, and he has learned laws, and he compares cases when he has a mentor and he doesn't go ask. If you have a mentor, you have to go ask the question. It's inappropriate to simply draw inferences on your own. And this is true if you take a look at source number 34. Rabbi Shlomo Luria makes the point, a ruler may not rule and compare cases where there is a great sage in the land. If you have somebody to ask, you do have an obligation to ask the question. And then, in addition, it has to be somebody who is dealing with those issues. Somebody who is actually involved in medical halacha. If you take a look at source number 35, Rav asked Rebbe a question in an area of halacha. Rabbi Chia came along and said to Rav, son of great ones, Bar Pachti, have I not told you, when Rebbe is in one volume, don't ask him regarding another volume. He may not know the answer. If he were not a great sage, you would have embarrassed him, for he would have given you the wrong answer. You have to ask him when he knows when he knows the topic and when he's involved in the topic. And this is actually brought as halacha in the Rambam. He brings it twice, interestingly. There's a discussion about why. But you can only ask if this is a topic he is holding in, as the saying goes. Now that's actually a problem, because source number 36 tells us that the definition of a Talmid Chacham is that he knows everything. That's what it says. Even Meseches Kala, which Rashi explains, means that he knows all of the Gemara, including even this esoteric area called Meseches Kala. So I don't understand. If he's supposed to know everything, then why am I wrong for asking him about anything? I should be able to ask him whatever I like. So there are a few different answers that are offered for this, and those answers matter. Tosfos there explains Meseches Kala differently, and then that's not a problem. It doesn't mean that he has to know the esoteric. It means that he has to know that which everybody is dealing with right now, and he doesn't need to know the esoteric. But the Chasam Sofer says that what it means is that when you ask him the question, you have to spell out the reason for your doubts, the arguments on both sides. Don't expect him to figure everything out. The Harad Tzvi offers another answer. He says that it's that you have to ask him If you have to ask him you're allowed to ask him a question that's superficial, that just relies on basic memory. But if it's in depth, he has to be involved in the sugya. It has to be something that he is immersed in right now. If it's not something he's immersed in, then it's not fair to put the question to him. What we're saying here is that it's not fair to put a question to somebody in some subspecialty or some side area if that's not what he's dealing with right now. Now, it's upon him, if he's not dealing with it, to be honest, and to say, I don't know. Right? To say, I'm not... But it's upon you not to put him in that position in the first place to ask him a question like that if you know that it's not what he's up to. And then the last one, and then I will take all the questions that people have time to stick around for. But the last item is that it has to be somebody who fits you. It has to be somebody you will recognize as a scholar, somebody of good attributes, somebody who is Yirei Shamayim, who is God-fearing, someone you know and can relate to. Rabbi Baruch Simon has an audio share on yutorah.org on this issue of Aseh Lecha Rav, making a mentor for yourself. And he points out that Moshe says, Re'ei Anochi Nosein Lefnechem Hayom, etc. See, I am putting before you a blessing and a curse and so forth. And he puts the emphasis on the word see. You have to see him. It has to be somebody you actually know. As opposed to, yes, you can have internet rabbis and rabbis you send emails to and so forth, but if it's not somebody who knows you, then you're missing something within the psalm. So in terms of this last area, this issue of what we look for in a rabbi, it has to be somebody who has a knowledge of the books, but it also has to be somebody who has the sharp mind to be able to analyze them and to make a proper analogy from the texts. Has to be somebody who has shimush talmid chachamim, somebody who has apprenticed for this. Has to be somebody who will ask you questions in order to make sure that he understands the situation. It has to be somebody who consults greater authorities. And it has to be somebody who is dealing with the issue at hand, so that he'll actually be able to know what what he's talking about. Those are all issues that that have to be looked into when one wants to find somebody to whom to ask these questions. I again apologize for rushing. There was so much to fit in. What I probably should have done is made this a two-parter instead. There are recordings. YU Torah will have the audio. KosherTube will have the video, and you can download them and listen to them. I am going to stick around to answer questions. Two other notes. One, going back to the question that was asked in the beginning, we absolutely are responsible to question. We absolutely are responsible to ask and not simply to say, well, this is it and it's done. But at the same time, we do have this recognition of humility in saying, I don't know everything. And if I'm going to only follow where my heart leads me, then that's all I'm going to get, is where my heart leads me, instead of something that may be informed by people who either know more or have a sharper mind than I do. And so that's a key point.
In the beginning of the shiur, a question was asked regarding the tradition among Jews of doubting and questioning, and how that interacts with the idea of choosing a rabbi and following the rabbi's counsel. A couple of thoughts. As I understand it, Judaism combines multiple demands: the intellectual honesty and intellectual freedom of the individual, and the loyalty to community and tradition established with the Brit at Sinai. Neither pole can dominate to the extent of excluding the other. A community which squelches the individual would write out Abraham and Sarah. An individual who rejects the voice of community and tradition runs the risk of becoming a Korach. More, the community which squelches the individual ignores the fact that new voices have something to add, and therefore becomes intellectually impoverished, while the individual who rejects the voice of community is left only to his own intellectual tools and loses the enlightenment of so many others. To my mind, the goal of the rabbi is to blend the influences of the two poles, to study the views of the individuals, including those of the questioner, and to keep them in mind when looking at the voice of community and tradition. Theoretically, a sufficiently learned individual could do this personally, but that individual would still lack another key component, which is objectivity.